Okay, I'd like to convene the Finance Committee. We're still waiting on a quorum, but I'll ask that the clerk take the roll as members arrive. But do want to make sure we allow plenty of time to get through this morning's agenda, and then we'll officially convene as soon as we have a quorum. Today, we're going to continue the process that we started last week with the fiscal analysts for the various divisions, each giving an overview of their accounts and also calling on the division chairs to give an overview of what they see as some of the issues that will be coming before their divisions. A little hard sometimes to predict everything that's going to come before a given division, but you know, they'll be commenting on those issues in a general way, and then we will finish up the education divisions this morning, and hopefully get to state government finance as well. Now, last week we began with Emily Adrian's giving an overview of the Early Childhood Learning Finance Division. And we can do one of two processes, either have the staff do the overview. What I intended last week was to have the division chair, after the overview of their division, make a few comments. And we ran out of time, and Representative Slawik was up next. So if you're ready, we can do it now, or we can wait a bit, Representative Slawik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It probably does make sense to do them in conjunction with the overviews, because I know that K-12 and higher ed have a lot of information, and that way we could keep them kind of concise.
Well, that's what my original intent was. I didn't get a chance to ask you if you were ready to roll right now, okay. So go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Talking a little bit about early childhood, I know that our new fiscal analyst, Emily Adrians, gave a good overview of what's happening in this area. One, we're very pleased to have an Early Childhood Finance Committee back in the House. Way back in 97, in my first term, we had this committee had first been started with Tony Kinkle, and then Barb Sikora had chaired it, and then there hasn't been one for several years, so we're back, glad to be back. As far as what we're focusing on is really three things. First is closing the achievement gap, which you're also going to hear from my colleagues is a big priority in their education divisions. How we do that at the early childhood and preschool level is there's a couple of strategies that are being looked at both by the committee and the governor and different members. First idea that's innovative and we're looking at is the whole scholarship idea. So giving scholarships to families, helping families be able to choose the right options, quality care for their kids, and helping them to get ahead that way so they're ready for school. The estimate is about 50% of kids ready for school right now. We want to look at that other 50% and how to get them up to speed. There's also something called allowances, sort of a similar type model, but you would give the money right to the families. And then the Department of Human Services has a slightly different model where it's tied to quality, and they're calling them, it's like school readiness grants. So there's a couple different ways to call it, but I think the big focus is how to close the achievement gap, how to work with at-risk kids. The second big broad area we're working on is that whole quality idea. Our committee has child care, which is really over half of our funds. So looking at, you know, whether kids are with grandma or they're at a center, how do kids need to be ready for school? What are some of the measures that the parents need to know and the families need to know? So we're going to be working on a number of bills related to that. How extensive does our quality rating system really need to be? Or how does it work with both family, friend, and neighbor care, as well as center care, as well as small child care? So I think we have a lot to think about, that it's not really maybe a one-size-fits-all perspective, and we need to really sort through how we're going to measure quality. And then the third area that we're working on a big broad level is sort of citizen engagement. So having the people of Minnesota, having the families of Minnesota, having the kids of Minnesota come and talk to us about what's happening in their child care situations. We know there have been big cuts in child care. There was a lot of eligibility changes where families can't get on the system that need it. We have the child care that's helping families bridge from welfare to work. So we need the families to be eligible so they're stabilized and can take over those responsibilities. So we're hoping to talk to families that have been successful, to bring them in and talk with them about what things they've used that we could potentially do in legislation that would help other families so that we can get kids ready for school and increase that 50% mark.
Okay, very good. Any members of the committee have any questions of either Ms. Adrian's or Representative Sawick at this point? It's been a few days since you did your presentation, so...
And Mr. Chair and members, I just wanted to iterate, if you have some time to digest the information and go through it, and you have questions, you know, in a few days or something, my phone number and my email address are on that front sheet, and or you can contact me through Representative Slavik as well, and I'd be happy to answer questions at any time.
Okay, I want to thank you both, then, and I was quite pleased that we do now have the Early Childhood Division. A number of years ago, I had worked with Speaker Carruthers to establish an Early Childhood Division when I chaired the Education Committee, and thought it was an important thing to do. The early childhood issues were really just coming to the forefront at that point in a major way, and felt that a division that had its own division, people that were able to really dig in and work on those early childhood issues was important, and I'm pleased that we're doing that again. So, thank you. We now have a quorum present, and we do have two sets of minutes, so would like to convene officially the Finance Committee, and we have the need for a motion. I know Representative Hilty was here fairly early today, so have you had a chance to look at the minutes, Representative Hilty?
Yes, so Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to move approval.
Okay, the motion is before us. We're approving both sets of minutes with this motion. Then, any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion carried. We also have in the packet today for you to look over the committee procedures. They're fairly standard and similar to what most of the committees have, but be sure to look those over, and we can discuss any questions that you might have about some of those if you would like at some point later in the meeting. And we also have the various bills listed that have been referred by the Finance Committee to the various divisions, or by me, by memo. So if you're keeping track of those things, they're included here as well. With that, then, we'll go. I just want to see if Representative Rukavina is here, because he's not here yet. His aunt passed away just in the... pardon?
His vice chair is here.
I understand that, but I think what we'll do is, I know he's in the building, but he did have a death in the family, and so we'll wait a few minutes. He did indicate he was going to be in, so I did visit with him a little bit just before the meeting. So we'll go to K-12 next, then, and Greg Crow. And welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Greg Crow. I'm the fiscal analyst for K-12 Finance. You should have in your folders a packet that looks something like this. Overview of school finance. We'll just go through this. Give you a quick breakdown on everything there is to know about K-12 Finance. And
5 minutes?
5 minutes.
We'll give you 10 if you need it.
Mr. Chair and members, the first chart is just to give you a context for the appropriations that are funded out of the K-12 Education Finance Committee. The pie chart shows that about 39.5% of the state's budget, general fund budget, is for K-12 finance, and you can see from the table that accompanies that chart that that amounts to about $13 billion for the fiscal 2008-2009 budget biennium. If you look at page 3, you can see that in a historical context. For about the past 4 years and for the next 2 years, we've been at about that 40% level for K-12 spending. This is actually E-12 spending, so it includes that 1.5% slice that's early childhood spending. There was a slight increase in 2006, an anomaly due to some repayments of some shifts that were made during the 2003 legislative session. But you can see that for about most of the history, it ranged between 30 and 35%, and now for the last few years, since the state took over the general education levy, that percentage has been at about 40%, and that's been pretty constant, and is projected to stay about at that same level. So where do schools spend their money? That's your page 4 chart. Where do they get their money, I guess? Education revenues by major category. This is for the fiscal 2008 base. You can see that the bulk of the money school districts get. Now, this is total revenue, and when you see in the education area, you'll when you see a word like revenue, that means both aid appropriated by the state and local property taxes levied by the school districts. So this $8 billion, $8.2 billion, represents all of the money they get from state and local sources. So you see the bulk of that money comes from the general education program, which is primarily unreserved money that they can spend however they need to, about 70% of their funding. Then the next largest component is facilities and technology funding, and that's 11%. The largest piece of this is voter-approved debt referendums for building projects and renovations. Then at about 8%, both special education, or what we call special programs, and operating referendum funding both come in at about 8%, and that's the largest, kind of the third largest pieces. And referendum revenue is unreserved, so it goes along with general education, but I like to split it out and show people how large of a piece of pie that those voter-approved operating referendums are. Sometimes you see in an operating referendum question that maybe your school district has proposed a designation of the funds for smaller class sizes, but by law those funds are unreserved and can be spent for any purpose that the school district decides. Now, when you look at that $8 billion, the next chart on page 5 gives you a sense of how much of that $8 billion is aid and how much of it is levy. You can see that state appropriations account for 77% of that revenue. Tax credits, which are also state appropriations, are another 1%. And then the net levy amount is about 22% of the money that the school districts get. Dedicated funds is primarily revenue from the Permanent School Trust Fund, which basically offsets some of the appropriation in the general education program. So how does that 77% compare historically? That's on page 6. You want to glance at that chart. And feel free to ask questions, interrupt and ask questions at any time if you've got a question about anything in particular. You can see
somebody's already ready to take you up on that then. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Aren't there some federal monies that come into this pot?
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, there are federal funds provided to school districts for fiscal. You can see on this chart. I'm just kidding. You probably can't see that chart, but
we have a copy before us, so.
Actually, I don't think I put this chart in the packet. I just brought it in case someone asked the question. But for schools for fiscal 2008, we're projecting $670 million of federal That's total federal funds. $601 million of federal aid for school districts. So about, if you look at all revenue sources, there's about $9.8 billion. So about, that would be about, you know, 6 or 7% federal funds.
Mr. Chairman, it just seems a sizable amount. I don't know what the hell it goes for, but it should be shown in it, shouldn't it?
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, sometimes we show federal funds and sometimes we don't. This chart is just kind of the state, the things the legislature has control over. So you control basically how much school districts can levy. You control what the state appropriations are. The federal funds are primarily directed for special education programs and the Title I funds for high-risk students. And those are basically just pass-through funds to the school districts based on certain formulas. So that's why they're not on this chart. If you'd like a chart like this with federal funds on it, I'd be happy to put it together for you. The other big piece of funding that's not in here is local fees, fees for athletic programs, fees for academic programs, any other kind of fee that a school district charges. That's also something that's in the what I was just looking at is the price of government report that does include fee information. I can certainly whip a chart together for you if you'd like one.
Well, if nobody else there, Mr. Chairman, I guess I don't either.
To see. Representative Earhart.
I say if nobody else cares about it, Mr. Chairman, well, I guess I don't either. But I would think that generally...
The amount, would that be difficult for you to put together, Mr.
No,
Paul?
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, why don't you do that
I'll,
then?
I'll have it for you for your packets for your next meeting.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Representative Garfiano. I blew that one.
Garofalo.
Yeah, okay, good.
But you know,
it's been 8 years since I've been in the chair, so...
I do like the fact that you didn't even try, though. You just said, what's the name? So that's good.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Crow, on page 6, the elementary secondary funding percent from state sources, I guess the first question I'd have is the items that are not included, kind of piggybacking on Representative Earhart's part, would that include federal funds, all property taxes, all fees? Is it a complete view? Maybe you could tell me what's not.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this chart also reflects the last chart that was in front of you and includes all state appropriations, whether they're tax credits or education aids appropriations. It includes dedicated funds, which is the revenues from the Permanent School Trust Fund and local property tax revenue in this chart. So it does not include federal funds and it does not include local fees.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Crow, could you, if I say please, could you maybe email with, first of all, do you have data that goes back before 1984 on this?
Back before 1984?
Yeah.
I think I've got everything I've got on that chart. And the price of government data that has fees and federal funds, I think this goes back to fiscal year 1991.
Because, Mr. Chairman, to the testifier, there's been a lot of discussion about the Minnesota Miracle and what the percentages are back in the early 70s. Do you know if that information would be available to committee members if we could compare, for example, the percentages that are in place right now versus what the education funding formula, this statistic in the early 70s was?
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, we had a question this interim that where we were asked to look back to the beginning of time, and we were only able to go back to about 1979 or 80 with good data. And so I don't know that we'd be able to, that I would be confident in the data prior to that to try and put together some information that would kind of track and be comparable.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Crow, in your expert opinion, again, I know you don't have the data in front of you, but do you think during the mid-70s or late-70s there was any dramatic shifts in policies that would have resulted in these percentages being higher? Or your best guess, maybe?
Mr. Chair, from the Garofalo, I don't even want to venture a guess. I wasn't even in elementary school back then. Or maybe I was just starting elementary school.
Maybe
Mr. Marks would want to venture a guess. I think he was given the budget that time.
Oh, the low blow. Mr. Marks, do you have any opinions you'd like to offer on this?
Mr. Marks? Now, Mr. Marks and I do go back to pretty close to that period of time, and I'm just sitting here trying to remember, because we used to talk about those percentages. Representative Freedom goes back almost as far as I do as well, so... I think Representative Swigum only within a term or two there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, the data, the problem is getting comparable data that has all the detail in it and so on. The discussions in the Minnesota Miracle discussions in the early 1970s were, there was always the talk of a goal of 70% state funding. As I recall, when we looked at data from those years, that I don't think it ever got quite to the 70% state funding. It was generally in the high 60s. And I think if you look at the 1970s, that was generally the range. Again, though, it's having comparable data to what we have now that's a problem. That was looking at state appropriations and local property tax levies, and then trying to bring the tax credits in to offset levy information and so on. But I think we have that general kind of information. It was that after the Minnesota Miracle, the goal was the 60 to 70% range. But I think getting precise data to do these kind of charts is the problem.
Sure. So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Marks, so the goal, and again, I want to make sure we're comparing apples to apples here, the goal was to hit state funding of 70%.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, that's what was expressed in the 1971 legislative discussions regarding what was called the Minnesota Miracle.
Thanks.
And I don't go back quite that far.
Okay.
But close. No, that's my, as Mr. Marks pointed out, that was my recollection during that period, that it was a goal. Representative Solberg.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to that point, this was a state goal, but there was also variations depending upon if your school district had a high property value or not. Some school districts were not what we called on the formula, and I'll give Monticello as an example, because they had two power plants that had great high valuation. So they probably received zero amount of money from the state, in fact, as I think they did. Whereas many states that had low property wealth probably received 85 to 90% of their valuation or their monies from the state. So that's the one thing that you have to consideration in the Minnesota Miracle, because funding, even though it was a big pot, a total amount of 70% as a goal, had varied greatly from school district to school district depending upon their valuation. And that has been taken out of the formula now in the last few years.
Yeah. I think Representative Solberg makes an important point. Here we're talking statewide averages. If I recall correctly, during that period, I think we may have had some school districts, or at least one maybe, that approached almost 90% state funding, as you point out, or somewhere in the 80s. And then I think we had five or six, if I recall, that were off the formula. And you point out correctly, I think the common denominator often was a power plant that's generated some of that. If I recall, I think maybe even the Becker School District was off the formula up in that region as well, and maybe even down in your area, Red Wing. So there were a few that were off the formula. Any other questions on this point? Representative
Garofalo.
Garofalo.
There you go.
Okay.
No, and thanks, Representative Silver. I guess the context of which I was asking the question is that I've heard members from the other body of the legislature talking about how we need to go back to the Minnesota Miracle. And I've been confused by that because, again, even excluding the commercial buyback that my friend Representative Simon pointed out to us, or excuse me, the property tax reform that went into effect in 2003, I mean, the numbers look like we've been doing a pretty good job for an extended period of time, going back through the late 90s, but also into the back to the mid-80s. And I just, I've been confused by that, and I wanted to make sure that I had the proper information from Mr. Crow and Mr. Marks.
Representative Solberg.
Well, you maybe look, when you look from the state down, that may be a true statement as a percentage of what we're paying. But from each school district, depending upon whether or not you had high valuation in the school district or low valuation, depending upon where the winners or losers came in. So if you were from a school district that had high property value, you became a big winner in this process. If you were from a low property value, you may have been a winner, but a really, really small winner.
Mr. Chairman and Chairman Solberg, I recognize, at least I think I understand the disparities that were in existence before that. My confusion arises from people saying that we need to go back to those numbers. We need to go back to the early 70s as a role model for us. When I look at the data, it looks like we're actually doing better than when the Minnesota Miracle was implemented. It looks like we're actually doing better, and I've been confused by those numbers, and I wanted to make sure I understood it.
Well, I don't want to get into the debate on this, but or discussion, I shouldn't say. If you come from an area that has high property value, yeah, you did real well in the last few years. If you came back if you come from an area with low property value, you probably didn't do so well. So, I mean, it's a philosophy as well as the numbers wise. So, if you're going to fund 100% of the education from the state, then as a philosophy, then everyone was a winner on that.
We've got several people on the list, and I assume they're all on this point. Representative Cornish, that's on the list.
If you want a good, unbiased opinion without trying to demonize either political party and make either one heroes or losers, the Rural Minnesota Journal put out by the Center for Rural Policy Development is a good study on school funding. It talks about the Minnesota Miracle and past funding and present funding and why it's still a complex thing that nobody seems to be able to get a handle on. Maybe I can get a photocopy and get it here, but it's a good, it goes way back with the facts and figures and some comparisons.
Okay, very good. And one reminder, by the way, those of you that are sitting on the inside, we are being televised, and it's difficult for them to pick up your voice on the mics unless you face in. There's a tendency to face either the chair or the witnesses, but the sound may not be picked up as well. So if you can keep that in mind. Representative Wagenius.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Garofalo, I'm going to look for some context, too, not because of age, but I think I was living in Africa at the time. So I have a question for Representative Marks, or for Mr. Marks. I had always assumed that the Minnesota Miracle was a proportionality thing, leaving property taxes and going to more state funding, so that there was a big change at the time, and so we were weighed down in mostly it was property taxes. Is my context right or wrong here? It was Minnesota at the time doing most of its school funding from property taxes?
Mr. Mark.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, and I wasn't here in 1971 either to make that point, but as I understand the Minnesota Miracle, the major concept was putting equalization in place so that there was still a reliance on property taxes, but it was that equalization. Every district had to levy a certain tax rate. State aid made up the difference between the tax rate and a guaranteed amount of money, and that prior to 1971, there were state grants and there were property tax levies, but the relationship between the two, this equalization, was not there. So the main concept was that there was now a guaranteed amount of revenue per pupil. Districts had to levy the same tax rate across the state, and state aid made up the difference between what the tax rate brought in on a per pupil basis and the guaranteed revenue per pupil.
Thank you.
Representative Stigham.
Chairman, thank you. A couple of questions. The first was going to be to Representative Solberg, but he left, so I will not. I'll ask that secondly. My first question then would be in the $6.4 million that we're looking at here for the year 2008, Mr. Crow. Are any increases in class sizes and student enrollment, student sizes statewide, is that included in that number?
Mr. Crowe?
Is in other words, is there built in a coverage for growth of students in the state of Minnesota in the budgeted forecast?
Yep. Mr. Chairman, Representative Swigum, the student counts are drive the bulk of our formulas, and so the calculation of how many pupils are going to be drive how much money the districts get, and in terms of class size, there's a reserve on a portion of the money the districts get that when they have additional students, they have to reserve additional dollar amounts for keeping class sizes down.
So, Mr. Bowman, Mr. Chairman, student growth is included in that anticipated expenditure of $6.4 billion for year 2008.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Swigum, it is our, and we'll see a chart later on pupil counts, but we're pretty flat right now in terms of pupils, but we do still have some growth in some of the programs because some of the formulas are driven by how many pupils of certain types there are, and there are, you know, growing numbers of students, for example, that have English as a second language, and so that drives additional dollars in that particular formula.
And that is, Mr. Crow, that is automatically built into the forecasted amount of the $6.4 billion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swigum, yes, unlike some other committees, the Education Committee, when a forecast is put out, the forecast, what we have what was called fully funded formulas, and the forecast allocates enough money, regardless of where our appropriations had been, to fully fund those formulas.
Mr. Chairman, the last question, and I see Representative Solberg has left, but as they were talking about the equity and the equalization, the high property values and not, you know, as you go back to the 1970s, we tried, I think, very hard in the state to bring some equity, so that if your community happened to have those power plants, or if your community happened to have high-valued homes, or now we see the increase in farmland, or if your community had a significant amount of commercial industrial property, or if your community, for instance, happened to have an iron mine, I assume, iron mines, those would be high-valued communities, and you would, from an equity standpoint, probably not get as much as state aid. If that's correct, Representative, or Mr. Carlson? Mr. Chairman, Mr. Crowe, that's correct.
I think you've covered all the bases we're asking, Mr. Crowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swigum, that's correct. That's how it works. The districts like Becker, for example, or Pequot Lakes with high value homes were off the formula in the sense that they didn't get any state aid because their local levy raised so much of.
So, Mr. Crowe, it was power plants, high value homes, increase in farmland valuations, iron mines, things like that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Swigum, iron mines are taxed. There's a whole separate taxing system for taconite and for those mines. So for valuation purposes, it was southwestern Minnesota with a lot of high value farmland. It was some of the high value homes, and it was power plants. And remember also, members, that when we talk about property value in the school finance system. And the equalization where we equalize those levies so that lower value districts get more state aid so that their tax rate and tax burden for a particular levy is the same as a higher value district. We're talking about property value per pupil. That's how we calculate all of our equalization. So if you have, even if you have moderate value, for example, if you have a sparse pupil count. If you don't have very many pupils, your value per pupil is going to be high. So in a lot of situations, we have small districts that have high value per pupil that you wouldn't necessarily look at those districts and think that's a high value district, but if their pupil count is low, they're high value per pupil, so they get more state aid on the equalization formulas.
So again, Mr. Chairman, clarify, Mr. Cole, my comments about the property valuations in a local community, a local district. My list is correct, except for the iron mines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simcoe.
Okay, so I had to exempt that from my list. Thank you, Mr. Cole.
Representative Rukavina?
Well, Mr. Chair, to that point, I was going to educate Representative Swigum on that, but I think he knew. He was just toying with me over there, I think, because, in fact, on the operating levy, which is an issue with seasonal recreational properties statewide, and school districts in rural Minnesota are finding out what the effects are to pass an excess operating levy when there's nobody to tax but the local homeowner and local business. They still, the cabins still do pay it on a capital levy in a school district. The Iron Mines pay neither, Representative Swigum. So while my district built schools in every place from Grand Rapids to Grand Marais, now last year the city school district of Mesabi East passed an $18 million capital levy, of which they get, we gave them $3 million of Taconite taxes, where all the other school districts in the Taconite relief area had previously gotten 80 to 100% if they were in Doug Johnson's district. then they got 100% of their bill paid for by the core range, but not when it was Mesabi East's turn, which was LTV, and there's no property wealth. All of a sudden, the local taxpayer had to pick up 80%, and the mining companies paid zero of that on a capital improvement levy and an operating levy. So it's the exact opposite. If there was a Minnesota miracle, we had an Iron Range nightmare.
Mr. Crowe.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, just a couple. We didn't really discuss this graph, the reasons for what's happening. You see most of the history, it was at about 60%. Then during the late 90s and early up until 2002 and 2003, we had an increasing share paid by the state. That was primarily accomplished through changes in classification rates on the property tax side. And then in the 2000, you can see in fiscal 2003, the buy-off of general education levy, the percentage went up to 87%. We also were doing some things with the operating referendum. But since that time, as property tax values have grown, the equalization formulas have provided less aid, and in addition, districts have gone out and passed a significant amount of operating referendum levies that have been paid with local property taxes, which drops that share down. And I've got some more detailed charts. We'll talk a little bit at the end about what's happening with referendums. So on the state dollar part, the general fund dollars that go to schools, how is that $6.4 billion broken out? The great majority of the appropriations that the K-12 committee makes come in the general education program, which includes the basic formula, which is kind of what used to be called foundation aid, the per pupil amount that every district gets, and then we have another dozen or so formulas that are calculated based on English as a second language students, sparsity, the geographic distribution of students, the number of free and reduced lunch price students. All of those are also counted as part of our general education program and included in that 85%. Then the second big, and that 85% includes referendum, but again, similar to the earlier chart, I've divided it out so that you can see that the state aid part of referendum is about 2% of what school districts get. Then the second biggest component is special programs, which is special education, and then education excellence is the third largest at 2% of the budget. That includes funding for things like advanced placement international baccalaureate programs, for the state's integration revenue program for charter schools, and just a wide variety of different kinds of programs kind of fall under that title of education excellence. And on the levy side, you can see the breakdown on page 8. There's some detail about what districts levy for, about $1.8 billion of levy for pay 2007, which is fiscal year 2008. The biggest piece is voter-approved debt. Those are, again, building projects, renovations that districts go out and get their voters to approve. And those are very partially equalized, and I think I've got another chart on that. But mostly, that's all local levy. The second biggest piece is referendum, operating referendums. Those are also voter approved. About 30% of the levies that are levied by school districts are for voter approved operating referendum. So you see that almost 70% of all the levies that are made by school districts are approved by their voters. The balance are authorized by you all in the legislature when you tell them that they can levy for certain purposes. There's general education as a category. It's not a single general ed levy like we used to have. We have levies for some components of general education, including the equity revenue formula, the transition revenue formula, and the operating capital revenue formula. And then there are some other general programs, which are general fund levies that districts make. There are some special levies for safe schools, for example. Districts can levy for security and other types of programs. The next largest is capital levies for health and safety, which is a specifically designated mandated list of things that districts can levy for in the health and safety area, and then 4% for other capital, which are not voter approved. One of the biggest pieces is building lease levy. Districts can levy for instructional space or to lease instructional space up to a certain limit, $100 per pupil per school district.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, so under that health and safety capital levy, could a district levy for physical activity, things like gyms or fields or something like that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, no, that generally health and safety improvements are things like asbestos removal. Health and safety is a term, you know, the physical health of the students or the safety of the students in the facility, definitely, rather than the instructional services such as physical education. So, Mr. Chair and members, I put a couple of property tax background charts in your briefing. I'm going to skim those since taking more than my allotted 5 minutes.
That wasn't a real allotted. I think we all understood the complexities of K-12 finance when we were saying that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to give you a sense of how those property taxes are levied in the state for taxes payable in 2006. 60% of the property value is in residential homesteads, 10% in other residential, and 14% in commercial industrial, 12% in agricultural. If you look at who pays the taxes, we have $6.2 billion of levies, and this is by all taxing jurisdictions. You can see that in contrast to the 60% of value, about 50% of the levies are actually paid by residential homesteads, and in contrast to the 14% of value that's out there in commercial industrial properties, commercial industrial pays about 34% of total property taxes, and that's because most of the property taxes are levied against net tax capacity, which assigns a classification rate to properties that shifts some of the burden from homesteads to commercial industrial taxes or properties. In the K-12 area, if you think back to that levy sheet, the big piece of pie called operating referendum is levied against market value. The balance of those property taxes are levied against net tax capacity. And if you look on your next chart on page 11, you see that school taxes account for about 25% of total property taxes in the state.
We have a question for Sub Pelosi.
Mr. Crow, could you clarify how technology could be funded? I've got a question. The governor brought up the use of an iPod in a classroom, and over the last few years, we've had an ongoing debate about whether or not textbook monies could be used for technology. And in this context, if you could create a digital textbook, and that textbook would be used in place of a classic paper textbook. And I'm going to go back to the governor again, where he was promoting this. We took testimony last year that at least one suburban school district, their social studies department voted to use textbook money for digital use. Is there clarification on exactly how the textbook, classic textbook money could be used for technology, or how technology money could be used to replace outdated textbooks with a new format? Could you clarify that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pelosi, we have a very broad statute that deals with textbooks, for example. We don't have a formula that funds textbooks. We have a broad statute in the operating capital revenue formula, and that's one of the general education programs formulas that has a list of things the money could be spent on, and one of those things is textbooks. But in addition, on that list, technology is included in the list. So there isn't in that category a state mandate that they can't have an alternative, you know, instructional method, because technology would be allowed under those usages. Now, a district may have designated a certain portion of their budget for textbooks or for, you know, traditional textbooks, and that required a vote of the teachers to want to reallocate that part of the budget, but that's a district-level decision. There's enough flexibility in the operating capital statute to allow districts to spend that funding on technology. And beyond that, the other technology funding that we have relates primarily to access, internet access. And
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Crow, I appreciate your answer, but then there is confusion beyond your explanation of the flexibility of the statute. Because clearly there are districts that will say, by law, you cannot move that textbook money for technology. And again, I bring it up because when we took testimony last year, I did call districts that had said you could not, and they were told from, maybe it's the department, and these urban legends grow, and maybe someone at the department issued a memo, and that memo has become fact and festered into law, and now out there somewhere we have districts saying they can't use it. So I'm just asking for clarification, because frankly, most of the textbooks today are sanitized, overpriced, worthless objects that go out of date between the nanoseconds you get it and the minute you put it into a child's hand. So the technology would be a much better use of those resources.
See,
it's a personal comment, but the first one is...
Mr. Crow is looking at the statute. What I was going to maybe suggest, unless he finds it real quickly there, is that we either revert back to that, or this might be a good topic for Representative Murphy or Representative Reiling to look at in the Education Division.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to help our governor clarify how you use an iPod in the classroom. I think he knows, but I really want him to know.
Yeah, I know. I understand where you're coming at it from. I was just looking at our clock. But it looks like he may have found it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Kowalski, the statute dealing with uses of total operating capital revenue includes 24 allowable costs. Number 20 is to purchase textbooks. And then related to technology, we've got to purchase or lease interactive telecommunications equipment, to purchase or lease computers and related materials, copying machines, telecommunications equipment, and even other non-instructional equipment, and to purchase or lease assistive technology or equipment for instructional programs, to purchase new and replacement library meter resources or technology. So it's written pretty broadly to allow technology purchases under that in lieu of or in addition to textbook purchases.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to take up any more time, but clearly there's a miscommunication between the school districts and that statute, and hopefully this urban legend could be put to bed.
And I think probably all three of the education chairs, I didn't mean to omit Representative Mariani, who deals with policy kinds of questions as well, so maybe this can have some further discussion. Representative, Mr. Crow.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, the next page 12 in your handout is a chart that I usually include when I'm doing this sort of presentation. Just to, a lot of times we have discussions about why school funding formulas are so complex, and one of the reasons is that there's not an average school district in Minnesota. None of you represent an average school district. We can calculate averages for just about everything we have, but there pretty much isn't any district that fits that qualification, whether it's based on tax capacity, based on enrollment. There's such a wide range of school districts, and so I throw this chart in just to kind of give you a sense of what we're looking at when we're looking at school districts. One thing that we tend to do in education is look at the 5th and 95th percentile when it comes to just about everything, because for a lot of reasons we have a variety of outliers both at the top and the bottom end when you look at anything. And so when you're trying to design the school funding formulas, it makes a lot more sense to even rather than looking at the average, to look at the 5th and 95th percentile. So I've put some examples of what I'm talking about on page 12. The first is operating expenditures per student. As you can see, the operating expenditures range between under $5,000 per pupil to over $18,000 per pupil. Again, on the high end, we have a lot of, this does include federal funds. There's a lot of, there's a few school districts that get a lot of federal money, Indian school districts, districts that are on the reservations, and so that drives up that high number. So we tend to look at the 5th and 95th percentile, but even in the 5th and 95th percentile, you see the range from $6,500 to $11,000 of expenditures with an average of about $8,000 per pupil of operating expenditures. This does not include things, the capital expenditures for building debt and things along those lines, or the food service fund. Then the middle chart shows you the variation in property tax valuations across the state. Again, actually, I don't have the highest and lowest on here, but the balance between the 5th and 95th percentile is $3,000 to $14,000 per pupil of adjusted net tax capacity with an average of about $6,000 per pupil. So again, you can see there's a wide range of districts with a wide range of tax capacity property value in their school districts. Then finally, on the bottom, I've got an enrollment chart just to give you a sense of what school districts look like in terms of enrollment. And what that chart shows you is we have a lot of very, very small districts and a very few number of very large districts. You can see that, for example, just in the first line, districts up to 500 pupils. There are 91 districts of that size, which is a full one quarter of all school districts. But their total cumulative enrollment of 26,000 pupils is only 3% of total enrollment. So you can see that those first three lines, and I wouldn't even call 5,000 a small district, but in up to 5,000 in districts up to 5,000 in size, that's 90% of the districts, but it's only 25% of total, or 43% of total enrollment. So you can see that bottom line, the large districts 5,000 and greater, only 11% of the districts are larger than 5,000 students, but they account for 60% of the enrollment in the state of students. And so, you know, when we're talking about funding formulas, we're talking about districts that are very different in terms of size, property valuation, things along those lines. And, Mr. Chair, the next chart
represents things.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Crow, I'd be interested in the question of correlation between the size of a district and performance. Performance of the district. If there's, I don't know if we can draw any conclusions or not, but would you be able to add another column or another two or three columns to your chart on the bottom? Maybe something in regards to the passage failure of districts of certain size, of the test scores of the students, graduation rates, dropout rates, anything like that. Could you add some columns that would might help us make a difference or make a decision possibly on the size of school districts and any correlation between that and performance?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Swigum, my colleague in House Research, Tim Strom, has over time done a kind of an ongoing series of charts that tie expenditure to results and the correlation there. I don't know that size has been in there, but I'll have some discussions with him about if we can, what kind of data we could put together on that. Part of the problem is just what you highlighted when you were mentioning results, is which measure do you use? Do you use dropouts? Do you use test results? If you use test results, which tests do you use to try and somehow aggregate the you know the multiple grade tests we have into one measure of performance? And that's kind of one of the issues we struggled with. But we can get you some of those charts to look at expenditure as it correlates to results, and I'll see what we can do in terms of size as it correlates to results.
Okay, Representative Wilkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just following up on Representative Swigum's question, it seems to me that the size, Representative Swigum, of the building might be more important than the size of the district itself. If the building houses 500 children or 5,000 children, might show a greater impact. So as you are looking, it would be helpful, I think, to look at building size as well as district size.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lagunas, we do have some building level data. That's harder data for us to get, and obviously there's over 2,000 buildings in the state. So to give you a meaningful printout goes from 10 pages to 100 pages. So it's something I can look at. I wouldn't be as optimistic about being able to give you a real meaningful analysis. Because of the number of buildings that we have.
There used to be.
I don't know that we talked about results data. I don't know that we even have the results data on a building basis. In other words, I don't know that we have a lot of results, test results, that kind of data on a district level. I don't know that we have that on a building.
There used to be some information like in national publications and so on of the ultimate size and thing years ago. I don't think any of those were referencing Minnesota specifically, but Representative Wagenius.
Well, if I could follow up, Mr. Chair, I remember when I was initially working on all-day kindergarten, and we were doing, we were allocating the money by the amount of poverty in buildings, not by poverty in districts. And I know that surprised a lot of representatives, and I can remember specifically Representative Betterman was so surprised that one of the buildings in Lowry, Minnesota, which was in her district, had extremely high poverty rates, but you never saw it because, as an aggregate, the Alexandria district looked great. But this particular building had very high poverty rates, and sometimes averages hide. So if we can look at buildings, we may see more, and we certainly have the statistics on poverty rates by buildings. We certainly had them 10 years ago.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Lagunas, the compensatory education formula, which uses the count of free and reduced lunch price students, is a building level revenue formula that we still have, and the allocation of the existing all-day kindergarten money uses the poverty measure on a building basis. And so it's not a question of whether we have data about enrollment and some of those things at a building level. I know the department, obviously, when they're doing their reports about results and some of their testing data is reported on a building level basis. I don't know that we have it or which of the results side measures are available on a building level. That's my only concern.
Okay, Mr. Kroll.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, I put some enrollment information in there in your packet. You can see on aggregate statewide public school enrollment, the top solid line is hit its peak in the early 70s, peaked again in the late 90s, and dropped for a while, but now is projected to be pretty flat. This points out what Representative Genius was just mentioning about masking data, that this statewide average masks the fact that there are districts, individual districts experiencing significant declines, and some districts are growing. But on a statewide level, we're looking at a flat enrollment projection. And you can see down at the bottom, non-public enrollment's been pretty flat, while charter school and homeschool enrollment has been growing in recent years. And we don't have as much data on charter or on homeschool enrollment. And obviously charter schools just are a product of the last 10 or 15 years or so. Then I've got a couple charts that I won't spend any time on. I'll just point out we've got enrollment by region numbers again. The metro area is the largest, and that's reflected in those size charts as well that we've talked about.
Mr. Crow, I believe we have a question. Representative Swigum.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. Going back to the last chart, Mr. Crow, if I could, Madam Chair, when you say we look at the chart of number of pupils, is that actual pupils? Is that actual students, kids, the bodies, or is it the Wadhams and the concentration numbers? Too?
Mr. Chair, we have about 800,000 headcount students, and that's why I said if you see our formulas, we do a weighting. And they didn't get into that, but we weight our pupils based on which grade they're in, and we have a factor that inflates pupil counts in districts with declining enrollment. So our actual, the number of pupils we use to calculate how much money goes out is about 950,000. So you can see that, so that's kind of how you know which pupil count we're using. This is at about 800,000, so that's the head count pupils.
Thank you, Mr. Crow.
We have another question, Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Crow, also looking at that enrollment chart, can you tell me what the impact would be of the last, particularly the last 5 years in regards to student of color enrollments versus white student enrollments? What are the driving factors in the last 5 years in terms of up or down and impacting this way?
Mr. Crow.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't know off the top of my head how it would impact the graph, the magnitude. I know it's up because we're seeing, with the immigration issues, we're seeing a lot more funding going out in the English as a second language revenue stream. So I know that in that group, we're seeing pretty good growth. But other than that, I don't know off the top of my head, but I can sure check and see. I get you some more detailed information on that.
Madam Chair, it's my understanding that, particularly over the last 5 years, that a good percentage of our growth in K-12 enrollments are being driven by student of color population. And that we've seen a pretty sharp drop in enrollments in white student enrollments, white student demographics. I think it's important for this legislature to understand the importance of that demographic shift that's happening in our state. And then when you couple it with the information in the following geographic area, that's a dynamic that's happening all over the state. I get around the state quite a bit, and it's rare nowadays, so I'll visit with superintendents or principals who will tell me that a good chunk of their student enrollments per building or even per district are largely being driven by student of color and immigrant population enrollments. So if we look at policy in our state, and we'll certainly be looking at this in my committee, I think it's really important that we understand the changing nature of our K-12 schools. And then also, hopefully, appreciate the fact that in some of these school districts, student population stability is being driven by student of color enrollments.
Mr. Crow?
Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to go to the four charts starting on page 15. We always include these when we talk about school finance because there's sometimes a disconnect between legislators and school districts, and we hope this tries to help explain what's happening. A lot of times you will hear we put X amount of dollars, we put so much money in, and your school district is saying we don't have any more money. And seemingly those are in conflict, but there actually can be true, or there can be some truth to both. And so I'd like to walk you through these charts and just kind of explain that. The first chart is total revenue in school districts. The top line is raw dollars. The bottom line, the dashed line, is inflation-adjusted dollars. You can see from the top line that, indeed, between 1984 and 2004, there was almost a tripling in the funding that was available to school districts. And if you're looking at your next chart on page 16 on a revenue per student, and this is headcount students, you see that the same thing basically happened. We've gone from about $4,000 per student to a little over $10,000 per student. On an inflation, even if you look at it on an inflation-adjusted basis, school districts have gone from $4,000 per student of revenue to $6,000 per student of revenue in that 20-year time period. But if you look at what school districts are experiencing in terms of cost, if you look at page 17, what page 17 does is says, well, if districts are getting more money in a couple areas, it doesn't help them in their general instructional purposes. One of those areas is building debt. In other words, if a district is building a new building, those revenues aren't available for instructional purposes. So the dashed line, the dark line, solid line, says total revenue per student. Then the dashed line is, well, how much revenue per student is there if you don't include debt? And then the dotted line is, what if we don't include debt or special education? And the reason special education is backed out is that's kind of another fixed cost that districts have. If they get more special education students, they may get more special education revenue, but they don't have money to, that doesn't give them additional money for regular instructional purposes. And in fact, it gives them less money because of how our formulas are designed and the proration built into the special education formulas. But if they have more special ed students, they actually lose money. And that factor isn't even calculated into this graph. And so the final chart, page 18, says, well, let's take those three calculations of revenue per pupil and adjust them for inflation. And you can see that bottom line, the dotted line, is a relatively flat line. It's gone from about $3,800 per pupil to a little over $4,000. You can see over the last 10 years, it's hovered pretty closely to that $4,000 mark. So that's kind of the explanation of why you can look at that first chart and say, well, we've tripled the amount of money per pupil that we've given to school districts, and why? So what's the problem? And this is why a district would say to you, well, here's our problem. We have these costs, and we don't have, and basically our funding has stayed adjusted for inflation and stayed relatively flat over recent years in particular. But, you know, since 1984, really, there hasn't been a ton of growth when you calculate inflation and a couple of different fixed costs that districts are facing. Then if you look at the chart on page 19, I've got a couple specific funding programs I thought you might be interested in. I'm not going to go into detail in the bulk of our funding formulas because it would just take too much time, but I thought some historical context for some of the issues you might be hearing about this session might be useful. The first chart on page 19 is special education funding. You can see that between 1998 and 2003, special ed funding was growing pretty regularly, and the reason for that was up until that time we had growth factors built into the special education formula. They varied, but basically special education is a capped program. In other words, we calculate the revenue, if we calculated the revenue needed to fund the formulas that are currently in statute, we would spend a lot more money than is available because we have this basically an artificial limit on how much we'll allocate for special education. Then when there were the budget problems around 2003, those automatic growth factors were taken out of the special education formulas, and basically that left funding flat. You see a slight decline because for a 3-year period, we, in addition to the growth factor, the formula included an adjustment for pupil, the change in the total number of pupils. And as the number of pupils went down, the cap actually went down on special education, even though actual special education expenditures for districts were going up. We have two special education programs. One is the regular. You can see that with the lighter colored bars, and the dark, the black bar is excess cost, which is provided primarily to districts with significantly higher special education expenditures than others. Right now, our special education formula underfunds special education expenditures in the range to $200 to $250 million per year, and that grows every year because those growth factors aren't in place. Special education is flat funding, and special education costs in districts are growing at about 8% per year.
Representative Fulbert.
Just a very quick question. What is the percentage over that time? What has happened to the percentage of federal funds that have come into the special education?
It is
a federal mandate.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, some of you might be familiar with the 40% goal. I think the high point we hit was 17.7%. It rose for a while, and then it started to drop a little bit now. And if I think the number is 100 and... Well, I shouldn't say, but if the feds fully funded that 40%, I think we'd have about 150 or 180 million more federal dollars for special education that would help address that cross subsidy that exists now.
So, do we have a percentage? Now, do you know roughly what the percentage is?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, I think we're at about 16% right now.
Thank you.
16.5%.
Councilor Crowe.
Okay, Mr. Chair, the next program I'd like to draw your attention to is the debt service program. I showed you over on the kind of the size of different programs, which are the biggest programs, and debt is the largest levy in the education funding system, and it's one where we try and where there are equalizing factors in that program, but the property tax valuations have grown so fast that most districts aren't getting any state aid to in that program. You can see from the chart that debt service has grown from about $300 million. We're projecting about $700 million in 2009. A few years ago, the Department of Education had projected that at the end of 2005, we would basically plateau, that there wouldn't be any more significant building debt accumulated by districts, that we would be at a point in the school building inventory where there wouldn't be a lot of growth. That's obviously not panned out, and districts' building needs continue to grow. You can see that, again, the dark part at the top is the aid, the state aid. The chart on page 21 does a little better job, just because of how small those bars are, of showing how much state aid is paid out in the debt service program. In 1997, we were at about 11%, and by 2009, we're projected to be under 2% in terms of how much of annual debt service. And when I say debt service, this is basically the mortgage payments districts bond for their building projects, and then they levy for their annual debt service payments. And so the state equalizes, pays part of those, and we'll be down to under 2%. For 2003 and 2004, the legislature increased the equalizing factors and added a third tier of equalizing for districts with a high amount of debt. And that kind of gave a short bump of that's why that little blip up in the state aid portion up to 6.5% those 2 years. But then again, as property values fell, the state aid share shrank pretty quickly. None of those equalizing factors are indexed for the change in property values. So as property values rise, more and more districts go off the formula, is our term for it, but their property value gets higher than the amount, than the equalizing factor of property value per pupil, and they no longer qualify for any state aid under those equalizing formulas. Okay, Mr. Chair, and the last chart I included is on the referendum program. About 90% of the school districts right now have operating referendums. You can see that on a per pupil basis, we're up to an average of about $800 projected for fiscal 2008, with about 125 of that coming in state aid, and the balance would be levied by local school districts. Just for historical context, you can see back in 94 is when we instituted the equalization of operating referendums, and you can see that's when the state aid part of the bar starts appearing. There are two times when referendums go down, and during both of those times, the legislature adopted provisions to eliminate portions of local school district referendums and then add an equivalent amount to the basic formula. In 1994, it was $100, and for fiscal 2003, it was $415. The most recent time, we took $415 off of every school district's referendum and added that to the basic formula amount, at the same time that a significant number of other changes were occurring in the property tax system, including the elimination of the general education levy. As a result, districts went out that fall and were able to pass a significantly higher number of referendums than had historically been the case. And so you can see, for example, that between 2002 and 2003, when the 415 was removed from the operating referendum revenue, that the average referendum amount only went down about $200. And that's because between the time the legislature passed it and 4 months later when the district started having elections, that passed a significant additional number of operating referendums. And you can see it only took about 3 years until 2006 that 415 was that level was when the 415 was BIOP was instituted, that level was reached again with passage of new operating referendums.
Okay.
Mr.
Crow, would you go back to page 3, and I'm just looking at your bar graph there on the education spending as a percent of the state's general fund, Mr. Chair. And so I'm just wondering, would that jump in the 2003 year when you're going from less than 35 up to 40 and beyond, does that include the, because of the 800 and whatever it was, $80 million state takeover? And so really that isn't education spending per se, is it, Mr. Quinn? That went to property tax relief, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, that's correct. That there was some additional spending at that time, but there was also, including the referendum buyout and the general education levy, almost $1 billion of property tax relief that was in the education budget as state aid. And that's why when we talk about money to schools, we talk about revenue, which includes aid and levy, so that rather than saying state aid per pupil went up between those 2 years, which it may not have, or the bulk of the increase wasn't new revenue, it was tax relief, we talk about revenue that includes aid and levy, so that kind of change doesn't mask what's really happening in terms of what revenue school districts are actually seeing. But you're right, the bulk of that wasn't revenue to school districts, it was property tax relief.
But Mr. Chair, and didn't some folks around here depict that as an increase to, I think, you know, maybe the former speaker,
Mr. Chair,
and others that depicted that as a revenue increase, but it really isn't.
Representative Rukavina, whenever I was asked, I was careful to point out that was an additional state aid to school districts. And what happened outside of this building, I wouldn't even hope or want to address.
I think Mr. Crow handled that one quite well.
Much better than most of us would as diplomats.
The next, thank you, Mr. Crow. And by the way, this obviously is the most complex presentation we'll have relative to the budgets, I think. There was a time when I chaired the Education Division of Appropriations, and we had the higher ed finance bill that would go through there. And Ken Nelson had the K-12, and we actually used to race on the House floor to see who would be able to present the bill the fastest. And the higher ed bill has changed immensely after merger and after the clustering of the research specials, of which there were like 100 of them at one time. So it's a much simpler one. But I don't know that we'll have enough time to get through Mr. Bird's presentation or not, because we still have Representative Graling to do or make a few comments. Actually, you started the other day, but you didn't get too far into it. But Representative Graling, and for those that arrived late, what I've done is asked each of the division chairs to comment on what they see as some of the major issues coming before their divisions, just to give the full committee a heads up on what we may ultimately see before us when the finance bills go through near the end of the session. So, Representative Graling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I am glad to have a turn here after trying to jump the gun last week. So I'm presenting here on behalf of Representative Mariani, who is the Policy Committee Chair, and Representative Murphy, who is the Education Finance Chair, and we are working very closely together on what I'm talking about right now. And the first thing, and it reflects what Representative Slavik talked about for early childhood, that we're also encompassing, and that is focusing on the achievement gap and the general overarching, trying to do as much as we can as smartly as possible with our limited dollars to end those learning disparities between low-income students and other students and students of color and white students. And we certainly support what the Early Childhood Committee has recommended as a very cost-effective way to have kids come to school, to K-12, with having less of an achievement gap. And then after that, one of our top priorities is all-day, everyday voluntary kindergarten, taking a look at the big topic of special ed. And we know that the federal government, even if they did cough up their 40%, our cross-subsidy that our schools pay with our state mandates, that wouldn't begin to address what schools are paying for. So we need to take a serious look at that. We have limited English proficiency, which is a cause of achievement gap. We're interested in libraries and technology, which, you know, those could be equalizers out in the community and in the school districts if we had more even opportunities in those regards around the state. Extended time, which is after school and summer school, that can help with the achievement gap. And having relationships in our schools for all students, which would include school support staff. So that's our major big topic. Our second topic is an excellent education for all children. And so there we're looking at the 3% each year on the formula. And you saw that chart that if you account for inflation and then take out the constants of debt service and special education, which don't equate to extra money for schools in every classroom, we have not done anything but be flat for quite a while. And so this would be rounding up from the implicit cost deflator. The governor's budget looks at 2% as inflation, the consumer price index, but for schools and government, we really ought to be looking at the other measure. And so that's where we get our 3%. We're looking at world language, gifted and talented college in the schools, advanced placement, international baccalaureate. Those are all things that would give an excellent education for all students. And then finally, we're working carefully with Representative Lencheski on property tax relief, equity, regional fairness, some of the things that have been discussed here today, so that funding raised all around the state is fair funding for all students, no matter where they live or what type of school district they live in. But we do want to make very clear that those are not a dime for the revenue for school districts. We want that kind of fairness so that the revenue can be fair, but that does not count in what kind of money we give to our students for our classroom. And so we're going to work hard to make that more clear than that's been in the past. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Berg, we only have a few minutes remaining, and we can either get started or wait until next we meet, and I'll let it be your call. We're so close.
Mr. Chairman, whichever the committee would like, I have a much abbreviated set of graphs compared to Mr. Crow's.
But we only have 4 minutes.
But we only have a few minutes, so whichever you want.
I don't think it's that abbreviated.
Well, I could get through it then.
I think what we'll do, because I also want to hear from Representative Rukavina and perhaps Representative Murphy. I don't know if it sounded like you maybe had deferred your comments, but being that you have all three divisions, I was going to have you for a bit of a conclusion, but that would be your call as well. Pardon?
I have something to say.
So then we'll have that as part of the next meeting as well, Representative Murphy and Representative Mariani, if you would like to comment at that point as well. So we'll the next time we meet at our next meeting, then we'll continue with the education agenda, and with that meeting adjourned.